welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, where I, Adam Lowther, and Jim Petrosky and Curtis McGiffin, your regular scheduled entertainers, come together to offer you a once weekly laugh fest in some instances.
Wow.
I didn't know
it changed the format.
Yeah. It's well, today, you know, we've got a great topic. By the way, it's good to see you guys.
Good to see you, Adam.
And, you know, today our topic, it's one that there's a lot of passion about. I don't know that there's that much laughter necessarily associated with it. It's not one of our funnier topics, but today we're going to talk about putting bombers back on alert. So, I think I hear the ring of audience laughter out there as we talk about this. But so putting bombers back on alert, it's a great topic. It's one that, I've been looking at here lately. It's the Strategic Posture Commission alluded to it and discussed it a little bit. Admiral Richard back in 2021 said, hey, if the Minuteman III slips, if the Sentinel slips and we have to keep Minuteman III longer, we're going to need to put bombers on alert because we'll have, miss Minuteman III age out. And, if Columbia slips, then we're going to need to put bombers back on alert because our numbers will go down. So it's a topic that, is becoming prescient as we see the delays and then thinking about what does it take to get bombers back on alert. And so I thought, what a great topic. And there's technical aspects of it for Jim. There's, for a aviator like Curtis, there's the air crew side of it. There's all kind of elements to this discussion, and it's one we've never talked about. So with that, let me just open up with you, Curtis, as the guy, as the navigator. As you think about putting bombers back on alert, we've had some discussions with Global Strike Command, and of course, back in 2021, OPE Dawkins, General Dawkins, said, hey, we could only do this for a very short period of time before we broke the force. And so this is, and we haven't really changed anything since 2021. So as we think about it, and as you think about it, sort of what's your take on why we might want to put bombers back on alert?
Well, thanks, Adam. And in a classic sense, I'm not going to answer your question. I'm going to answer the question I want to answer. You said something that's very interesting, and I do, I always think about Admiral Richard and his statement back to that Senate a testimony about, what he might have to do with the bomber leg. And there was sort of this collective, shock, both, within the halls of Congress and I think within the halls of the Pentagon that, geez, put bombers back on alert. That's a big diplomatic thing. That's a big money thing. That's a big force impact thing. But this is one of the key attributes of the bomber leg is its ability to cover for the other two legs if there's a challenge, right, Adam? I mean, if there was a gap in missile coverage, you could bring the bombers up. That was the thing we always sold, the whole capability, right? If there's a gap in subs, we can bring the bombers up. And this is a way to utilize that. And all Admiral Richard sort of said was I might have to do these things. And there seemed to be, some sort of outrage. And so that's one thing. The next thing I would say is that I hate the idea that we accept risk because it's cheaper and simpler. because to not accept risk is too hard. The idea, General Dawkins, respectable guy. I've known him a while, and he is a very deep thinker in this space. But I think the idea of saying that we shouldn't do something because it's too hard is the wrong answer, and I may be oversimplifying his response. The answer should always be is if that is the need, if that is the requirement to maintain stability, safety, security, peace, then by all means, we need to create the force to do that. Because that goes to the third point that I want to make here, Adam, is that the worst thing you can do with regard to deterrence is to continue to tell the adversary what you won't do or what you can't do. And I think that that is just, it's just counterintuitive to what we're trying to accomplish here. And those are my first thoughts on that.
So for you, Jim, you would have been the guy on the ground when the bombers delivered their payload and U.S. forces had to go through that zone. You would have been the guy to make sure that our forces maneuver around it safely. So this actually matters to you as well. It probably matters to you as much as anybody. So, you know, when I throw it over the transom to you, Jim, what is your take on this? It's because it's a question that's being bantied about right now.
I'm going to follow Curtis's lead, and I'm not going to answer your question directly. And I'm going to apologize up front to our audience. If you go back and listen to Adam's Lowther's introduction, just letting you know in his show prep, I'll never again tell Adam he's not funny enough as he tries to pull out humor from a non-humorous topic. So I apologize. That's my fault. But so let me start first of all. I like Curtis's comments about deterrence, and they're spot on. You don't tell your adversaries you can't do something. You don't limit yourself up front. But Adam, you said, well, you know, Jim Petrosky, you know, talk about the technical aspects of this. Okay. I'm sort of a bread and butter kind of person. So what does it take to put bombers on alert? We know how to build, from a technical standpoint, we know how to build airplanes and we know how to make them fly. We know how to train pilots. We know how to train bombers and navigators. We have all that capability. We still have that capability. We know how to take nuclear weapons and stick them inside the bomber. And we know how to make them fly and communicate with them while they're in the sky and refuel them as they need to be refueled. So from a technical standpoint, all the components are there to do this. What we don't have maybe is enough of these to be able to do this. And that's the question of why we're in this situation. Why are we in a situation that we can't use something that we had agreed many, many years ago to be the piece that fits in between by saving money, putting them on the ground and saying, well, we'll just pull them up when we need them. Well, maybe we're starting to need to have the bombers in the air. And maybe we need to have that visible show that we're serious about using our nuclear deterrent as the way it was designed to be used, not dropping bombs necessarily, but certainly if we need to, but showing that we have the resolve and the capability to do so. And that is one of the best aspects of the bomber. You don't want, not everyone's going to be driving by a missile silo every day. Although a few episodes back, someone mentioned in one of our, either one of our podcasts or potentially in one of our Husey events, saying the American public probably doesn't have the desire to see a mobile missile launcher driving by their house every day. They can drive by my house. The street's pretty clear. They have a 28-foot extra space for tractors and farm implements. There's plenty of space. I'd feel very comfortable seeing them traveling, mobile launchers traveling by my house on occasion. I actually get excited on Memorial Day when my neighbors drag out all their World War II gear and drive by my house. And everyone gets out and cheers and talks about that. So I think the American public gets it. We just need to have the resolve from the leadership standpoint to say, this is where we're heading. And now, how do we do it? Not we can't do it. So I go back to Curtis's comment. What is the requirement? And I thought the requirement of bringing the bombers out of the sky and putting them on the ground, we're going to save time. We're going to give people more crew rest, but we're not going to get rid of the darn things and we're not going to get rid of the parts. We're just going to put them in a different modality. And when we need them in that place, we're going to put them there. Well, if we're needing them now, what happened? We've got to get ourselves out of this cycle. We've got to get out of the cycle of making a decision to use something and then suddenly get rid of it as we haven't seen it used for a while. I just don't understand that. Now, to your point about technology, Adam, and a guy on the ground is probably the most interested in this. I would say that the need for strategic, the need for strategic bombing, the need for our deterrent is, as the guy on the ground, I don't want to have to be shooting back. I want to have nothing to shoot at because I don't want us to be at war. And the way you aren't at war is you show that resolve, that capability, and that response so that you don't have to go to war. Peace is so much nicer for a guy like me or any one of those soldiers sitting in a foxhole somewhere or in a tent somewhere or in a desert somewhere right now. Peace is so much nicer than picking up your duffel bag and dragging it around because someone's shooting at you. That's not what we need. So that's my technical answer to that, Adam. And I know I went a little long and I wasn't so funny either. I'll let you do the humor, Adam. Go ahead.
So, you know, what's interesting is if you think about where we are with the bomber force today, we've got 46 B-50 nuclear capable B-52s, 19 B-2s, and our crew ratio, because right, you've got crews that you got to care about. You've got maintenance, you've got security forces, you need aerial refueling, you need, you know, facilities. You know, your alert facilities, you have all these supporting components. And during the Cold War, we spent more than 14,000 straight days on alert. Every single day, the bomber force was on alert. Every single day from 1957 to September 27th, 1991. And we managed to do that. And we had a lot more bombers. We had a lot more of everything back then. And now, with what is essentially 65 aircraft, we can't put them on alert. So it's a much smaller force, but we still don't have enough. You know, our aircrew ratios today are 1 to 1.25 instead of the 3+ that was required during the Cold War. You know, we don't have enough security forces. We don't have enough maintainers and munitions guys. We don't have the refueling aircraft. We don't have alert facilities that are in shape. We're sort of in a bad way.
Adam, but my point is, why are we at that point? Where, you know, working the strategic bombing side of it, being part of the security forces, those are incredibly important. And I would say satisfying positions, if you know what you are doing, you're protecting your family, you're protecting your community, you're protecting your country so that we have the freedoms that we have. What an honorable thing to do. Why can't we get the people in and develop those people so that we can have this instead of saying we can't do it? I mean, I'd like to hear a little bit about Curtis. I never served. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's, you know, it's just, you know, nothing burger. You don't do anything. You don't build that crew sense. You don't get to learn about the people around you. You don't get the sense of leadership and be interacted with them. You don't get to do that. Maybe that's the case. I don't think so. I think these special people that do it because they understand that sense of commitment, that sense of honor, that sense of responsibility. Can you imagine at that, an airman in security forces realizing you are protecting a nuclear weapon that is keeping us at peace and could be used as a way to stop an aggressor against our country? I mean, how important can, you know, how unimportant can we make you feel till you realize that's not something to do? I doubt that happens. And so I'm curious, Curtis, you were on those crews, you interacted with people. Can you share with the audience a little bit about what that was like and why we think this is an important mission?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So just for the listeners, I actually did a NIDS knowledge podcast on Nuclear Alert last October of 2023. I highly encourage you to go find that on our website, thinkdeterrence.com. But I'll tell you, as a guy who sat alert for a lot of his flying career in the 90s and early 2000s with Looking Glass and the National Airborne Operations Center, not bombers, but still sitting alert. I was sitting alert when they weren't, so to speak. I enjoyed that time. It was a great time as an aviator, even though you're not flying. Feels weird. Sometimes you would fly on alert, especially in the NAOC. We would fly on alert all the time. In the Looking Glass, we wouldn't fly at all. And so you generally sat on alert for a week, Wednesdays to Wednesdays, and then you would get off. You'd switch, have a crew switch out Wednesday morning, and then you got basically the rest of the time off. It was something that was called C-Square, and it was an acronym for crew rest that sort of made up for all the time you had off. And so you basically had the rest of Wednesday and all of Thursday and Friday off. And if you didn't have any duty scheduled on the weekend, then you really didn't come back to work until Monday. And that was a great time to spend with your family and so forth. And then when you're on alert, you're doing all kinds of aircrew testing. You're getting training done. You're doing other duties that have to be done. Maybe you're studying for your master's degree. There was all kinds of time that was afforded to you, and your family could come out and visit. So it really wasn't that bad of a time. And at the height of the Cold War, crews would sit alert once out of every 3 weeks. And that's why, Adam, you needed that 3-to-1 or 3 crew ratio per jet. Sort of rotation. You know, we started sitting alert. The order to go on alert was in 1955. General LeMay ordered us to go on alert. And his idea was that if one third of the alert force could survive a nuclear attack, that threat would enhance the credibility of deterrence. And that was so much so that when Kennedy took over in 61, he ordered that ratio to 50%. And so by July of 61, there were 664 bombers on alert carrying over 1,400 nuclear bombs and another 494 tankers on alert to support them. All those aircrew, maintainers, cops, everybody providing the support and service. This is why we had SAC bases all over the country, because you needed all of that ramp space and these airplanes sitting on Christmas trees. And a lot of people think, oh, and the goal was that there would be 200 aircraft taking off every minute across the country to meet that threat, all, you know, nuclear armed or the tankers to support them. And the idea was that you would have that was the guaranteed retaliation. That was the essence of mutual assured destruction and second strike guarantee. That was essentially the Cold War. And not only was it about retribution, but it was also about surviving the weapons. Adam, you talk about this all the time. We've got nuclear weapons sitting in facilities that are not that hard to find. And those that are loaded onto these bombers, if they take off and survive the initial attack, those weapons survive too. And I think that's one of the key things about putting today's weapons back on alert is to survive those weapons, because we're not going to turn around and build new ones once the war is sort of ongoing. We pretty much have what you have. And so the value of that is key. This is part of the deterrence mentality that I think the Air Force needs to really sort of embrace and find ways to make this something of a great attribute to them. And again, this is a consequence of deterring with a dyad, not a triad, because the bombers are not on alert. We have accepted risk. And so now if we put these bombers on alert, it will change the status quo. And this bothers people everywhere from the disarmament community who want to see fewer nukes engaged to those who are counting beans and dollars to say that it might be too expensive, and everything and the diplomats who are concerned and everything in between. But that doesn't matter when your adversary is threatening you. You've got to do things with the assets that you have.
Yeah, and wouldn't you say that with the spin, you know, people look at it and say, well, we don't have enough people. The spin-up's going to be hard. And I agree, spinning up from where you are to where you were is big, because when you guys were working together, you know, and I think of my early career days when I was out with my unit and out training almost every day. We go to the range, we go to, you know, do various things. You're training all, you know, training together all the time. There's a dynamic of leadership, a dynamic of fellowship, a dynamic of collegiality and proficiency that you build in that. So you actually get better and more efficient at this as it goes on.
That's right.
The spin up would be hard, but there's so many other things that would be valuable for our military in terms of making it function much better and much more efficiently. And of course, be more of an environment of working together than you do in this fashion. Did you see that as well?
Yeah, I think the cohesiveness of the operators and the maintainers and the cops, they're living together, in these facilities. They're all hours of the day and evening. They're socializing together because they're sequestered in certain parts of the base, and so this. I don't know. It just allows a lot. It's a different culture than what we're used to today, I think. And not necessarily a bad culture, I want to say, because I think it is about what we were. That mentality is the culture that I think the Air Force has been struggling to revitalize under this. And I'll say this last thing before I give this over to Adam, is that if for those who say that we can't do this, the generals and the congresspeople and the politicians and the disarmament crowds, it is only because we don't prioritize it. It is only because we don't want to do it is the reason why it doesn't get done. It isn't that we can't do it. If you throw enough resources at the problem, you can get it done. It has to be the priority in order to get it done. You know, President Biden reminds us every time at the end of his speeches that there's nothing we can't do if we don't do it together, and because we're the United States of America, and we can do all of these things. And so we have to be able to identify the risk and then identify the mitigation to that risk. And sometimes that mitigation is hard, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be done.
So 660 bombers on alert, which wasn't even the total force during the Cold War. Now
right.
We have a total of 65, not even 10%.
1%.
And that's
right?
our total force. And so, you know, well, it's 10%, but it's
10%.
But that's Thank what you. We've got. And we still can't put them on. We can't put them on alert. And because we can't meet the requirement that's 90% smaller than we were able to meet during the Cold War. And
right.
we've more than doubled in size as a nation. We've got more people. We're wealthier.
Right. But Adam, it's not 10% of 60. It's only 46 bombers, right? At least I'm talking B-52s. And so the B-2s, that's such a hard one to consider because of all of the other missions that are assigned to it. But when you think about the B-52 and how many nuclear versions that have been, you know, again, arbitrarily sort of selected after a New START treaty that's now 14 years old, and we are the only ones adhering to it. And so what we're looking at here now is this challenge that of those 46, you know, you're going to have those that have to fly. You've got hangar queens. You've got this. So it's a fraction of that. So you're telling me we can't put on 8, 12 of those 46, 16 of those 46 can't sit alert? Is that what you're telling me, Adam?
Yeah.
Yes, that's what I'm telling you at this moment. That is not doable.
You're messing with my mind because you're throwing numbers around so quickly. I'm not a good numbers guy. I'm just a nuclear engineer.
You're an engineer, Scotty.
So, but there's another piece of this from a podcast we've done recently where we've talked about the ICBMs. And I think in recognition, at least if we're going to recognize, we can't put the bombers on alert. That even pushes more of an emphasis on the need for the ICBMs as well. And so now you have a double-edged problem when people are trying to take that away too. What are you left with? I mean, it gets to the point of almost insanity when you begin to look at the numbers and what we were capable of doing, as you guys said, we were capable of doing at one time, but now we say we're too big, we're too rich, we're too whatever that we can't do what we used to be able to do. I find that a difficult argument to make.
Yeah.
Especially when you have two adversaries who are growing by leaps and bounds in their strategic capabilities. And that's not what we had before that was motivating us. We only had one. What in the world's going on?
Right.
Well, I think it's to me, the bombers and our challenges with putting a very small bomber force on alert relative to what we've done in the past is a micro, it's an example of the microcosm of almost abject failure that is where we are today. It highlights how far we've come as we've sort of gone down in our capability over time and what we've now accepted as the norm. And so now we have bombers that are essentially useless in a nuclear conflict. And I've had people say, well, you know, Adam, but we'll have time to put them on alert because, you know, escalation is slow and gradual. And in no way is that how wars begin. They are not slow and gradual. They begin with a bolt out of the blue. That's normal. And so the idea that, you know, if you think about, if you just run the public numbers say that, you know, we put 20 ALCMs on a B-52 and we put a few less than that on a B-2. So, you know, if you basically go 65 times 20, you know, that's approximately 1,200 weapons. And so if we don't have bombers on alert and an adversary were to just strike the weapon storage areas and destroy the weapon storage areas, maybe they can do it with a conventional strike. Maybe it takes a small nuclear strike on the WSAs, or let's say they attack, you know, Minot, Whiteman, and Barksdale, and you take out the bomber force with purely conventional, you know, cruise missiles that are shot from a Russian sub in the Gulf of Mexico. We lose a huge percentage of our nuclear capability right there. And so when the disarmament advocates are saying, hey, we really need to just get rid of the ICBMs, they're too expensive, we just can't afford them, they're the only actual leg of the nuclear triad that requires you to strike it with a nuclear weapon. The submarines, if they just started going out doing, you know, deterrent patrols and then never coming back and we don't know what happened because they've been taken out because the Russians, you know, figured out the signal, you know, the sound that they emit and therefore they can pick them up and they've developed new technology, who knows what it is. They become vulnerable. They're only, you know, our most secure leg because of the current technology that exists. But the moment the Russians get better, the Chinese get better, they're not secure anymore. And so this idea that bombers don't belong on alert, it really makes us, at risk in terms of our ability to have an effective deterrent.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, all right. All right. I'm just going to say my piece and I'll be short, Curtis. So, yeah, but again, and then there's all these secondary issues that we don't lay out. You know, the training aspect, the spin up time, the lag time in doing this. Plus, another thing that I didn't mention last time, I was going to mention, was that, you know, you mentioned our adversaries. So our adversaries, China's building all these capabilities for flying, but they're not building airplanes because they're going to slowly ramp up a war. That's why they don't actually put airplanes on the ground. They're just, or missiles in their silos. They're just putting them there so they can slowly ramp it up over a couple of years so we have time to respond. I mean, that's the way they're doing it, right? I mean, this is just, again, this is just unfathomable about how we're responding. And we're actually, you know, my view on it is we're actually asking them to do what they're doing. And that doesn't help us at all. We could, with bombers on alert, we have something in the sky. They see, they know we're ready. That's the other important piece. Go ahead, Curtis. Sorry.
No. I say that, or my thoughts to add to both of your excellent points is that this is just a continuing failure may not be the right word, but it's just a continuing resistance to accepting the world as it is. We are still, I think, as a community here, living in a time frame that was formed about 15 years ago, and we just refuse to adapt to the threat. We talk about the threat. We understand how the world is changing, and how our adversaries are getting more lethal and more coercive and aggressive in what they're doing. Yet we continue to not want to react to that. And whether it's this irrational desire to not upset the organizations that are already upset and they're already doing their thing, or just an unwillingness to change the business as usual, because if we do, then we are in fact acknowledging that everything we've hoped for over the last 30 years with regard to nuclear weapons is just not ever going to happen. And I'm just disappointed that in America that fancies itself to be this nation of example, wants to do sort of this idea that it's just not going to do the things that it needs to continue to be that example, or enforce peace. We're so worried about how the rest of the world will view our action, or how they might react to our action. We just don't even seem to want to acknowledge that action is already happening and that we are in fact reacting. And it's sort of a confusing argument, which is why you have to have learned thinkers in these spaces. Maybe that's not us, but here we are. And I think that what we have to do is react, accept the world as it is. And then we need to react and adjust our behavior to that new world. If you ever hope to bring it back down, you're going to have to go on that ride up, right? It was Reagan's old idea of building up to build down. But there are certain things we have to continue. Let me say this differently. We have to stop self-deterring. We have to stop allowing our adversaries to successfully coerce us into not doing the things we need to do to resist them.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we are out of time. So it's been a great discussion. Glad we had
a
chance to talk.
Did we solve this problem, Adam? Did we solve this problem?
I'm pretty confident we did not.
I think I'm going to take offense to Curtis. I think we are the thought people on this. We've been through it. I've lived through the Cold War. It was good time. To live because we stayed at peace. We had no major wars during that time. So I would say that in and of itself tells us a little bit about what we did in the past, and we can rehash that. There's nothing wrong with that.
We know how to do it.
That's right. But there's nothing wrong with that as long as we go into it level-headed. We have all the experience from those years. And so I'll turn it back to Adam to close us out.
Well, folks, hopefully you're not looking in your dictionary and saying, what was that thing? Oh, it was the Dunning-Kruger effect. Yeah, that's what I've just been listening to. Hopefully that's not what you're thinking about. We think it was a pretty good discussion. But it just brings up that where we've been, what we were able to do, sort of where we are and where we need to be. And if you really follow the sort of the ebb and flow of the discussion, that's really sort of what we've talked about today in terms of the putting bombers back on alert, which, you know, this is a big, important topic. So even if we just spurred you to say those guys are wrong, they don't know what they're talking about, then I would encourage you to go look at these issues of bombers on alert. Think about it yourself, put your own time and reflection into it, and contemplate for yourself, is this something that the United States needs to do, and what would it take? And for those airmen listening, you know this better than anybody. You know what it takes. And so keep thinking about it, because we may very soon reach a point where the decision has to be made that this is what we're going to do, and therefore we'll need, you know, you to help make it happen. So as always, of course, thanks, Jim. Thanks, Curtis. Enjoy the talk. Surprisingly, there was far more laughter than I bet you anticipated, Jim. So the topic can generate humor. So
unlike you, Adam, I don't ever anticipate any humor. So that's good.
And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.